Welcome to Everyday Strong, the podcast that teaches parents, teachers, and other caring adults how their everyday, loving actions can help their teens cope with anxiety and depression.
Hi, everyone. It's Michael Ann, the director of Everyday Strong. I'm here today with Alan Paoli. He is a therapist at Revere Health, and we've had him on before, and we just love what he has to say. He is a clinical mental health counselor, which is one of my favorite kind of counselors. I highly recommend that certification because they always have such great insight, and Alan does in particular. And we're going to talk today about what do we do about the professional help side of things, especially when our kid is kind of resistant to it? So, Alan, thanks for being here today.
No worries. I'm super excited about it. I had a blast the last time, and it's for me, this is my life, and this is my passion, and this is what I spend the bulk of my time doing. So I'm always excited to talk about what I think makes great mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a moment ago, we were chatting and you were telling me about fishing and how fishing is like therapy.
Yes. And honestly, you would be surprised at the number of times I've actually taken kids out for a therapy session while actually fishing. Uh-huh. I've found that a lot of the kids I work with, especially the kids that are in juvenile justice services custody or the Division of Child and Family Services custody, they don't typically have a lot of patience for things we do in the office. But suddenly when I take them out to one of the local ponds or streams and I put a fishing rod in their hand, suddenly their patience grows exponentially. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of great discussions while we're out there about a variety of topics. Mm-hmm. They like the idea of doing something while talking about something else. They tend to lower their guard, but probably the biggest thing that we walk away from with those fishing experiences is their level of patience grows, because they can't just force the fish to bite on their hook. They have to, take a lot of great care to bait it and to throw it out there in just the right place and make it as attractive as possible for the fish to latch onto it. And it's just, I'm like a lot of those older guys that tends to gravitate towards fishing, because it's just got a lot of great value for me in terms of helping me become more patient, as well as it's just a way to relax and unwind and power down from all of the different difficulties that we're kind of faced to deal with. So.
Well, and I love this because, so like I said, we wanted to talk today about, how do I know if my child needs therapy? Like, how do I get them into therapy? Like, I don't know. And I think sometimes people want like a specific script. It's like, if I say X, Y, and Z, and then my child will react, ABC way, and then suddenly they're in therapy, problem solved, right? But I love the way that you're describing this of there's something here about like creating the environment, crafting the environment, thinking really carefully about like what will allow like a relationship to sort of naturally emerge, that there's so many principles in what you just said.
Yeah. And the idea of, there being this really set cookie cutter approach, it's a nice concept, but it really doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. Just last week, I met with some of the internal medicine doctors over here at Revere Health, just to do a little reminder to let them know that we're still available and we're able to talk about any number of needs that their patients in particular come up with. And one of the questions that came up by one of the physicians was with the issue of insomnia. And, like a medical doctor, he has a very specific prescribed approach for dealing with these kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. And, with insomnia specifically, most of the insomnia, we just don't know why it happens. Mm-hmm. And so it could be any number of issues as to what causes it. And so one of the things I tried to really advocate with those physicians is that, yes, we can absolutely treat insomnia, but the very prescribed approach that they typically use with the medical model doesn't always fly with what we deal with. because there could be any number of issues that cause insomnia. And some of them are directly related to sleep. You know, like maybe the room isn't quite dark enough. But more times than not, there's a lot of underlying stress that really kind of needs to be addressed and cleared out in order for, you know, their patients to kind of get to get the kind of rest that they're after. So, yes, the cookie cutter approach would be nice, but unfortunately, there's a lot of ambiguity because we're dealing with so much individuality with each person that walks through the door.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, like, we, like, know a lot, right, about whatever the mental health thing is, anxiety, insomnia, you know. Like, we have a lot of principles, like you said, room kind of, like, you know, colder or cooler, like, you know, wind down before bed. And, like, we talk a lot in Everyday Strong about how, you know, things are, say, multifactorial. There's multiple factors that go into it. And unweaving that and untangling that can sometimes, it feels tricky because it is tricky.
Yes, yes, I would agree. And I would say the thing I love about mental health, which is the ambiguity and the challenge and not knowing what I'm going to get from one patient to the next. And even from, you know, I could see a patient for several months and then suddenly out of blue, they present completely different one day because variety of issues. And so it's the thing that we love. It's also the thing that we kind of dread about it. And it's very difficult sometimes for people to understand that. In fact, one day I had a young adult come in who was on the autism spectrum and he became so frustrated with all of the relationships he was trying to deal with that he just blurted out really loud where he said, "I don't get human emotions." And I, you know, I gave him a high five and he says, "You're not alone." I said, "I do this for a living. And there's lots of days where it doesn't always make sense." And that's, you know, again, the tricky part about it, but it's also the thing that as therapists, that's what we love most about what we do.
Yeah. So I'm thinking like, you know, if I'm a parent and I've got this kid and like, you know, he or she just like does not want to go to therapy, right?
Of course.
And I kind of want to say the same thing to them where they're like, "This child is driving me crazy." And I'm like, "Yeah, like me too," right?
That makes sense. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. And so like, how do you as a parent kind of like, I don't know, just learn to even cope with the difficulty of like, you know, because it's one thing as a therapist, like the child comes in for an hour and then you can send them away, right? But if you're living with this person day in and day out, how do you build up your own resources so that you can keep going?
You know, and that's an awesome question. And I see that really especially focused with caregivers. And I have a running joke that probably the two most common populations that come to my office are going to be nurses or anybody in the medical field, and then teachers, because they're the ones that are kind of on that front line. And one of the questions that we're always asking one another, and especially as I go to conferences and I'm visiting with colleagues, the question that gets asked most often is, "What are you doing for self-care?" Because the day in and day out of having to fight some of these battles, it, it gets exhausting. And it's easy over time to start to wonder if maybe you're the issue here and not, you know, the behaviors that you're having to deal with. And so practicing that self-care is huge. And that's why I alluded to fishing. For me, that's my personal hobby. That's something I've done for several years, but it forces me to kind of power down. It allows me a chance to be outdoors, which, you know, there's a ton of research that supports, you know, sunlight and fresh air and not being so pressured by being in a confined space. That's kind of my go-to for doing things. And so the one thing I'm making sure that I do all the time, and even on a daily basis, is making sure that I've got something to look forward to, whether it's being outdoors or a book to read or a show to watch or even a particular snack. One of the funny things that I experienced growing up is that my dad did computer sciences for a living and he was very tight-lipped about what he did. He worked on a lot of military contracts, and so I really didn't know much about him. And so anytime I would ask him about how his day was at work, he always talked about where he ate, which I just thought
Oh, funny.
was incredibly funny and but very much in line with my dad's personality, because that was kind of the joy he found throughout the day to kind of manage some of his stress. And then of course there's always the physical activities that we would do together, but really self-care is just a really vital part. And I like to use the analogy of, when you go on an airplane and they do all the safety stuff and they say, in the event of depressurization of the cabin, oxygen masks will drop from the ceiling. And the first thing they always tell you to do is to make sure you put it on yourself first and then the others. Because if you don't do it, if you don't take care of yourself, it's next to impossible to take care of somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot about there was this article that I read at the very beginning of the pandemic in the Deseret News by Sarah Israelson, and she talked about this is maybe kind of a dramatic example, but I'm kind of a dramatic person. She talked about this prisoner of war who got caught in like a, I want to say it's a Vietnamese prisoner of war camp. And he would always say that like the people who just like gave up and just said like, whatever, nothing's ever going to change, like died very quickly. But also the people who were like, oh, we'll be out by Christmas for sure. Like they also died quickly because they
Yes.
kept having this like false hope, right? And so to just like go from day to day, like, I mean, it sounds almost like silly to be like, what's the snack I'm gonna have? But it's like not the snack, it's like the ability to enjoy like each moment that gives us the courage to keep going, I think. Does that sound true to your experience?
Yes, and actually that example is not weird or dramatic at all. In fact, probably the first person I've heard use that example was a guy named Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl was, he's well known in our field. He lived in the concentration camps in Germany, and he said the exact same thing. And in fact, probably one of the biggest tenets of his approach was that he found that the happiest people were the ones that went about focusing on the here and now and giving away their last piece of bread or comforting the person right in front of them, rather than focusing on, okay, I've had a dream, we're going to be liberated on this day here. And then when that day comes and it doesn't happen, then suddenly you're let down. And so it becomes really important, especially given the ambiguity of mental health and kind of the long-term chronic nature of it, especially as we're talking about, the basic things that we see like anxiety and depression. Anxiety is the most common diagnosis, and moderate depression is the second most common. And so as we learn to live with it and manage it and it just become, that piece of our lives that we have to deal with, much like we do with eating and sleeping and going to the bathroom and exercising and going to work and just starting to really normalize it. That's how we navigate the sometimes the complexities and the chronic conditions for which, especially as parents, we just want to sometimes even pull our hair out and just scream at the top of our lungs, say, why does it have to be so complicated? So yeah, your example is not far-fetched at all, and I don't think it's dramatic.
Well, and I personally really love it, right? Because I just think, I mean, I don't know. I mean, so many of the parents that I talk to, it really does feel like a battle, right? It's a battle to get your kid to get up and take a shower. It's a battle to get your kid to like whatever. And like, and you say like, want to go to therapy? And they're like, absolutely not, right? And it's this feeling that I think it can be really difficult to endure. And I'm curious actually on this question of therapy. Like, I've been thinking a lot lately about the balance between like just meeting our kids' needs and trusting that they will do their best like when they can, right? And also like you're the parent, right? Sometimes you need to just like take away the phone, like be like you're going to therapy whether you like it or not. Like what sort of the I don't know, it's, like how do you balance those two?
With kids, you don't want to get locked into those power struggles where It's I'm the parent, you're the kid, I know more, you don't. So do what I say. And I think there's definitely times when it has to be done. Like if your child is running into oncoming traffic, absolutely. You want to use that strong imperative voice that says, you know, get back here now. You know, to me, that makes sense. But when it comes to any kind of resistance to doing, whether it's therapy or, you know, maybe a band practice or softball or anything else, that's when you kind of open the door to having a dialogue with them. And I'm just not normally a fan of, on stuff like this, bribing kids or giving a punishment with them. I'm really a bigger fan of talking about it with them and talking with the idea of trying to understand their perspective. And one of the things I love, especially with younger kids, to get to that point is finding that routine or maybe a better word would be rhythm. Finding a rhythm that works for them. And kids, especially younger children, are really great at getting into a nice, steady rhythm. And one of my most favorite times a day, and I don't mean this because I'm done and I'm exhausted, but I love bedtime. And it's not just because it's like, oh, great, we get some quiet time. We can, you know, sit and have some time for ourselves. But bedtime really represents, from my perspective, a surrender of sorts. This is when kids are at their most, typically they're, you know, they've let go of a lot of barriers and disagreements. They've essentially surrendered. They don't have that high energy level that they do after school gets out and they're just running all over the place. They're really in a very soft and pliable place. And that's where I start to encourage parents to have those discussions as they're getting ready for bed. You know, using books as a way to model the kind of behaviors that you want. I've got a favorite author by a guy named Kobe Yamada, who's written some great picture books about, you know, trials and perseverance and learning to plow through things. And I like to use those as opportunities to start to, you know, like I've talked about before, being curious and seeking to understand and asking those questions and even, you know, exercising some vulnerability. I encourage parents to make sure that they check their ego at the door when they walk into those rooms to get that needed information. And it's not uncommon that whatever battle you had going on during the day really isn't at all what's going on inside of them. You know, for example, if you've got somebody who maybe doesn't want to go to band practice, it's not because they don't like playing the instrument. It could be an anxiety about not doing well, or or maybe they were asked to perform a solo piece and they're scared about doing it. And so we get into these, you know, tug of wars or these power struggles about these issues that really just aren't an issue, but taking that time to, you know, get on their level, whether it's laying next to them in bed or sitting on the floor or just doing something that's very much soft and pliable. And these are the kinds of things that helps to invite that feedback that you need to understand what maybe is driving, whether it's not wanting to go to therapy or doing some other activity that the parent feels is particularly important for them.
I love this so much. I love it. I mean, I love, like, whether you're out fishing or out for a drive or bedtime, like, I mean, I don't know, like, I am definitely a poet, and so I like to look for those sort of, like, softer moments, right? And kind of, like, really paying attention to, you know, what things feel like in that moment. But there's so much there that you're saying where the atmosphere that you're cultivating can change everything, it seems like.
Yeah, and that's just, I mean, I have a general rule that kids are broken up into thirds, a third biology, a third choice, and a third environment. And sometimes it's just kind of interesting as to which third wins out and which third you maybe need to emphasize a little bit more, because you could have a great environment, but there's some other issues going on.
Sure.
But at the very least, by keeping that door of communication open, you increase the likelihood of discovering what may be driving some of these thoughts and feelings or behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so I'm trying to think. There's definitely this question, I think, you know, about well, you know, because you were just saying, like, there's, like, you know, biology, choices, environment. And do you have any advice about how to kind of, like, suss out, you know, and I like to think a lot lately about taking the next smallest step, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. I think parents want to just, like, I mean, people just want to solve the whole thing, right?
Right.
And I always tell them, like, you didn't end up in this situation, like, overnight, and you're, unfortunately, you're probably not going to solve it the same way. You're going to solve it the same way you got here, which is taking yes. step after step. And so if I'm kind of trying to figure out, like, okay, like, which of the third is it here? Or even just, like, which of the third do I kind of start with strategically? What's your advice?
Well, and I really like what you said about that, those steps, mm-hmm. because we want the very first several steps to be super teeny tiny. Mm-hmm. We want this mm-hmm. to be a seamless mm-hmm. Approach with it. And it's kind of one of my gripes about New Year's resolutions, because mm-hmm. New Year's resolutions are always, you know, well-meaning, well-intentioned, mm-hmm. but they seem to be too big of a first step, uh-huh. which is one of the reasons why I think we abandoned them.
Yeah.
But if we make those first several steps really super tiny, letting everybody know that, yes, you get credit for even trying, that tends to be where I go from there with it. Mm-hmm. And it could be as simple as having a discussion, mm-hmm. or it could be as simple as, you know, driving by the office, or just even talking about it a little bit more in everyday conversations. Mm. I think one of
When you say driving by the office, you mean like driving by the therapist's office?
Driving by the therapist's yeah. office, or any other place that you want them to go.
Yeah.
Like uh-huh. one of the challenges that uh-huh. we see here, uh-huh. because I'm attached to a family medicine clinic, uh-huh. and everybody asks when they come in to see me, especially kids, like, am I going to get a shot here?
Oh.
No, I promise you, you're not going to get a shot at uh-huh, all. Uh-huh. And so it starts to kind of lower that fear and that anxiety a little uh-huh. bit. But the other thing I worry about is that sometimes we use the therapist as sort of like the I'm going to tell on you person.
Uh-huh.
Like, we'll go talk to the therapist and we'll go have them change it, rather than mm-hmm. it being about let's go talk and see what's going on and just come up with some ideas about what we can do things maybe a little differently, or even I can, you know, as the parent could do things a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I love it when, especially on those first couple of visits, parents come in with the kids, because it's usually an eye opener for them. I just think about somebody I saw recently where I watched a mom out of the corner of my eye get very emotional as her daughter just started to open up about mm-hmm. some very sensitive issues that were going on. And it became very cathartic for not only this teenager to open up, but mom to start to realize, oh my gosh, I didn't recognize these things were going on. And then I made sure to let mom know that this isn't, you know, fault on her part or anybody else's part. Sometimes it's just about having that other perspective and a different environment to help bring up some of these questions and these issues.
You know, this is actually really interesting, because I'm thinking of a friend in particular who's got, I think his son is like 17 or 18, and the son is like, has a very cynical attitude about therapy, right? He's mm-hmm. like, that dude isn't going to help me at all, right? And I actually kind of, I'm like really interested to suggest or see what he would think of the strategy of like him as the dad being like, hey, I'm going to therapy, and it would actually be really helpful to me if you would come with me so I can learn to be a better parent.
And I use that approach even with couples too,
uh-huh,
where
uh-huh.
because I never assume that I'm going to get all the information that I need uh-huh. off of one person. I, uh-huh. I like a variety of perspectives, and it's uh-huh. you know, I'll reach out to, you know, especially teachers, because they're on the front line. They see kids in a lot of different types of environments where mm-hmm. they have to actually practice these skills that they need to be learning in session or at home.
Mm-hmm.
To me, everybody gets a place at the table. Everybody has an opinion. Mm-hmm. And whether it's the youngest and the smallest in the family to the mm-hmm. oldest, everybody has something worthwhile to offer. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon for me to get a perspective and then start to make course corrections because, I mean, even though I've been doing this for quite a while, I don't have any problem recognizing that I'm not going to get the picture that I need or the information I need to make better decisions without having more voices at the table.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, of two things in this situation. Like, one is like what you're just describing, that like people sit in an environment, right? They sit in a context of other relationships. And also, like, I don't know if this would feel like underhanded, but just like, I mean, I think some kids, like, they just, they don't see any use for them, but you get them in a room there, and I think they can maybe start opening up, like, you know, as they see their parent willing to go first with the vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And then it's not about, like, I'm sending you off to this other person to fix you. It's just, like, I think there's a vulnerability there of, like, I feel a little helpless, and I feel like I don't know what to do. Like, help me help you.
And isn't there great power and strength in that? I think we look at that approach sometimes as a vulnerability as being this weak or bad thing, but mm-hmm. it really starts to create the kind of environment where everybody is on the same page. And, mm-hmm. and my feeling is nobody ever gets to a point in life where they're above reproach or where they can't screw up. And, mm-hmm. and the moment you think that, to me, is when you're just mm-hmm. begging to make a mistake. Mm-hmm. But always being open to the idea that you might be wrong on this, or you might not even be wrong, but just have you need an additional perspective with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's mm-hmm. sort of kind of leveling the playing field and working together. And you can do that just as easily at home by playing a board game together where you have a general discussion about different mm-hmm. topics. And it also allows you to become very approachable, which is what we want with parents. Mm-hmm. All the research says that parents are the single biggest influence on the mm-hmm. life of a child. Mm-hmm. And then siblings tend to be a distant second. And contrary to popular belief, you know, athletes and entertainers, they're, you know, way down the road. But it's those people that have that daily interaction with each mm-hmm. child. And, you know, for me growing up, I grew up in a very large family. Mm. I would easily say that mom and dad and siblings. And then, of course, I had two teachers that really stand out that just, I don't think I would be here today if it wasn't from the feedback and input of all of these people in my life.
I love this. And I always want to emphasize, you know, to parents that this hopefully feels inspiring, right? I think sometimes parents are like, I'm the biggest influence. Oh my gosh. But it's like, I mean, this means that you have power, right? And it means that you can trust your relationship and that even if you're not doing it perfectly, you're helping and you're supporting them just by being you.
Well, and we don't want anybody to do anything perfectly at all. I mean, the thing that really gives us great value is our flaws and our imperfections mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the having the good days and bad days, because mm-hmm. then you become not just relatable, but approachable. And we want to know what kids want to know, what parents are learning from their own mistakes. And, mm-hmm. you know, admitting it, I never think is an admission of weakness, but really an admission of great strength.
Yeah, an opportunity to go to grow closer. We always say in Everyday Strong, like, connect by apologizing, which really is like blown my mind the more I think about it, of just the ways in which apology can actually bring you closer to someone.
Yeah, the very act of apologizing you communicate contrition and humility, mm-hmm. and it's really not as much about apologizing for the act, although that's what we focus on, but it really just communicates, I'm sorry, I'm open to some feedback. What can we do to kind of have an improved relationship or figure out what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's talk for a moment about logistics. So we've done some great philosophizing and principle giving. but let's talk about, like, let's say that we kind of have sussed out, you know, that, like, there is something here that, like, we just need some extra support. Like, who do I, like, do I call my kid's teacher? Do I call, like, my insurance? What do I do?
I would say you really kind of take a broad approach with it. Mm-hmm. You talk to people, I think first, you talk to people that you know and trust, and mm-hmm. if they have any experience with it. And yes, I agree that teachers and probably physicians are going to be your best resources because mm-hmm. they see the behaviors that are going on, and they have an idea on at least who and where and what and how is going to work best. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not exactly what your child needs, it gets that ball rolling and you get that momentum going where it starts to open the door to other options. And again, like I mentioned earlier, we don't ever use the cookie cutter approach. Mm-hmm. It's nice, but I mean, even my own family of five children, I still can't get over how unique and different all five mm-hmm. of them are, even though they were raised in the same home with basically the same rules. They have kind of their own little quirkiness about them. And what works well for one may not always work well for another.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I will say that, you know, if you're not totally sure, like you said, pediatricians, like, I have been really impressed lately, actually, especially within the Revere Health System. That's my general practitioner. But they seem very well informed about, like, best practices, and they know a lot about, like, what medications seem to work and, like, how to make referrals and even, like, what kinds of therapy might be beneficial. And so I think that is a really, really great place to start.
Well, and I like our setup because I'm attached to a family medicine mm-hmm. clinic, mm-hmm. and it's very common where I'll meet with somebody and I'm concerned about a behavior or medication, and I'll kind of put them on pause for a second and go mm-hmm. see if there's a walk-in appointment. And almost always one of the other physicians, they're able to see them. And then the best part is they've got access to the charts, mm-hmm. and I'm able to share a little bit of feedback about some recommendations that I have for them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really appreciate everything y'all are doing in the community. And it's been so nice to see you bring on these additional, because the mental health, the behavioral health side is pretty new, right?
Yeah, I was actually brought on about 6 years ago as sort of a little bit of a test case, but mm-hmm. it's just taken off from there. And, mm-hmm. and many of the other offices under the Revere Health umbrella have added at least a practitioner who's there several days a week or mm-hmm. even just one day a week.
Yeah, and I think this is increasingly common. Like, I mean, Alpine Pediatrics, I mean, I'm just hearing more mm-hmm. and more pediatrician offices, like, you know, working this in because they know this is a huge crisis. And so that is a really, really great resource. So we kind of have, you know, you've done that. What are your thoughts about, like, do you know anything about resources for financially affording therapeutic help?
You know, the one thing that's changed over the last 20 or so years is that there's been many changes within the law to help move mental health funding and resources more to the forefront mm-hmm. of what we do. For example, you know, 30 years ago, if you had a mental health issue, there was almost always a separate deductible for it. So mm-hmm. it kind of put it on the back burner. But over the years, Congress has passed numerous laws. And the last one, if I remember right, it was back in 2008, and it was called the Mental Health Parity Law, where basically if you have unlimited visits for medical needs, you also have unlimited visits for mm-hmm. mental health needs. And so that's kind of helped, you know, sort of destigmatize the process behind mm-hmm. it. And then every insurance company and every office has got their own policies in regards to finances and what they're able to do. And sometimes there are some resources available. Obviously, within each county, they've got their own public mental health provider. And in Utah County, it's Wasatch Behavioral Health, which is just a, you know, fabulous service. And I've friends with many of those individuals. And the director, Jürgen Korbanka, is an absolute stud to work with.
Yeah.
And has really increased the availability of these resources for, you know, whoever needs it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
it may mean that you have to kind of, you know, ask some questions, but there are a lot of resources available and it's getting better and better all the time.
I'm really just so impressed. I mean, I think we're really rising to the challenge as much as we can, even with the limitations. And a couple of resources I'll throw out there as well, you know, for people. I always really love the NAMI mentors. So yes. NAMI, NAMI, that stands for National Mental Health. Nope. National Alliance for Mental Illness. And if you go to NAMI, Utah, you can actually call and talk to someone who has been through the mental health thing with their, even with their child, and they can help you navigate to different resources that are available or even problem solve, like what to do next. Like you said, Wasatch Behavioral Health is a great one for low cost. One of my favorites, I know that probably most people listening to this are English speaking, but the Community Health Connect actually has a network where they will link Spanish speaking patients, clients, to Spanish speaking therapists for free or very, very reduced cost. So those are just a handful of things. We'll drop those in the show notes as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So just to kind of like round us out, I would just love to hear kind of any of your last thoughts about, especially like, let's say, you know, you're going to come to your child and you're ready to have that conversation and you feel pretty certain that they'll be open to it. Like you think they might be willing. What are some of the ways you can open that conversation that will help them see how much you care and not make them feel broken?
Well, I think for starters, I stand by the idea that calmness is contagious. Mm-hmm. I think when you go into it with a very calm approach, with not looking to fix per se, mm-hmm. but just to understand, it really has a way of communicating that this is not a punishment. This is a chance to get some insight and some understanding. I think also sharing even some personal anecdotes or personal experiences that you've had. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be anything over the top, but relating and talking with your children. When I was this age, this is what I felt like. Mm-hmm. And then asking the question, what was it like for you? Mm-hmm. And so it becomes this little bit of a back and forth sharing moment rather than, you know, I'm the parent and you're mm-hmm. You're the child and you're going to do what I say. Mm-hmm. I think you're more likely to have them want to go into counseling or do anything else that you'd like. Like I said, whether it's, you know, band or orchestra or mm-hmm. volleyball or softball or church or anything else, just by being, you know, sometimes we forget the need to be human. And mm-hmm. and oftentimes with parents, I tell them the gift of humanity is probably the best gift that you can give your kids.
The gift of humanity. Yeah. And it is so hard when we're dealing with our own things, our own fears, our own inadequacies, right? But so often, you know, even thinking about when I was a teenager and like, you know, feeling my own sense of depression and whatever, I was just grateful when my parents were real with me, when I felt like I could be real with them. And I think that has been easier for one of my parents than the other. We won't name names. but I can see, you know, looking back, how much of an impact that makes of just like knowing that there is like that love and support and that sense of like, you know, we're in this together and I have your back. I mean, it's hard to overstate how much that can help people get through really hard things.
Yeah, that relationship is just, it's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate having you on today. Thank you for all your insights.
No, thank you. This is a lot of fun for me to talk about something that I'm really passionate about, and I see a lot of great benefit from.
Awesome.
If this episode resonated with you, you can check out our free resilience handbooks and online learning at www.everydaystrong.org. These tools tell you exactly what you can do to help the kids in your life feel safe, connected, and confident. You can choose to create a relationship with your children that will help them to learn to be resilient, regardless of the challenges life throws their way.